From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, coming to you from snowy Manchester, New Hampshire, and the thick of the nation's first 2016 presidential primary. In case the wild roller coaster on Wall Street hasn't got your attention lately, the presidential primary campaign should. The candidates are all over the place on their prescriptions for the U.S. economy, on taxes, the banks, American infrastructure, American jobs. It's a big span this time out, from Bernie Sanders' democratic socialism to Donald Trump's grand promises, and all while the U.S. and global economies show some real wobbles. This hour on Point, the candidates and the American economy. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on which candidate's economic vision speaks to you. Is it still the economy, stupid? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. All kinds of speeches going on for weeks and weeks now in New Hampshire, people meeting in great halls and little living rooms, voters right up next to the candidates. And still, what have we learned? We're going to dive in today at a town hall in Peterborough, New Hampshire on Sunday. Republican Texas Senator Ted Cruz outlined his tax reform plan.
The simplest and best tax reform is we ought to adopt a simple flat tax, where every American can fill out our taxes on a postcard. And when we do that, we should abolish the IRS.
On a postcard and abolish the IRS. Right here in Manchester yesterday, Hillary Clinton talked about the anger and fear that Americans, particularly young people, feel about the economy and the greater state of the United States.
When I think about what young people today have gone through, what they have known of our country, starting with the horrible attack on 9/11, going into the Great Recession, there is no wonder that they, along with so many of us, are saying, wait a minute, we're better than this. We can do more.
And last night I was out with Donald Trump, me and I don't know how many thousands of others at an arena just across the way from where we're sitting right now in the center of Manchester. Presidential candidate Donald Trump laid out his plan for improving any number of aspects of the country, America.
We're going to have a better country. We're going to have better services. We're going to have better roads and airports and hospitals. And we're going to pay less for them.
Better, 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 make America great again. And people in that hall were really eating it up. They were ready for the message. We've got a great panel with us here in Manchester, New Hampshire on primary day, looking out over the city where voting is happening right now. Heather Haddon is here. She's covering the 2016 presidential campaign for the Wall Street Journal. Heather, it's so great to have you.
Thanks so much for having me.
With us as well, Ross Gatell, former professor at the University of New Hampshire's Whitmore School of Business and Economics, now chancellor of the Community College System of New Hampshire. That's right in the middle of big economic questions. Ross, thank you so much for being here.
Good to be with you, Tom.
And our own On Point news analyst and New Hampshire man, Jack Beattie, is here. He's been covering the campaign in a special On Point newsletter. You can sign up and read all of Jack's notes from New Hampshire at our website, onpointradio.org. Jack, it's all happening right here today.
Hello, Tom, Heather, Ross.
Great to have you all here. I mean, Heather, the span of what we're seeing here, when you think of it, I don't remember a presidential election where you've got everything from Bernie Sanders to, I don't know who defines the other poll. I'm not sure it's Donald Trump. We think of Trump because of Trump Tower and Trump's billions, but I'm not sure he's the biggest sort of full-on laissez-faire capitalist out there. Who would you put at that end of the spectrum?
I'd actually say it's Ted Cruz, and I think it's exactly the audio that you played at the top. And before he dropped out, Rand Paul was actually very similar to Ted Cruz. And this really shows a larger split in the Republican Party between more traditional business conservatives and the more libertarian wing of the party. You wouldn't necessarily think of Ted Cruz as being a libertarian, but his tax policy, if you come down to it, is actually hedges more in that side. So you led with the audio about his flat tax. So that is something he talks about on the stump constantly, and he uses that postcard analogy.
File your taxes on a postcard and no more IRS.
That's right, and it lights up the crowd. I mean, people do eat that up. Now, what it actually means is twofold. One is a flat tax on the income side. That would be 10%. Obviously, that would be lowering taxes for a great number of people. And then on the corporate side, it would be a type of business flat tax. That's how he puts it. It's also can be seen as analogous to a VAT. A value-added
tax.
Now, what's interesting about that is those are very common in Europe.
This is where there's a built-in tax on everything that's sold.
Yep. In Europe, it's typically thought of as on goods and services for corporations. In Ted Cruz's proposal, it would be eliminating corporate taxes and eliminating payroll taxes. Payroll taxes is what usually funds what we use now today to fund Social Security, Medicare, these essential programs. So he would get rid of those taxes and just have this flat corporate business tax, which, again, is not usual conservative think. This is very unusual.
It's not an orthodox, a year of orthodoxy. Bernie Sanders, not orthodox by recent Democratic Party economic platforms as well. Ross Cattell, look at the Cruz plan for a minute. I was with him yesterday, just as close to him as you and I are sitting right now, and he was questioned about whether this is a VAT, a value-added tax. He said, no, it's not a VAT. It's not a VAT, but, Heather says it is. Others say it is. Just look across the board at what he's proposing. Do these numbers add up? A 10% flat tax plus these other changes, do we still have enough money to run the government and make things roll?
Yeah, the simple flat tax really is not that simple. And it's not very simple to understand what are going to be the implications of a flat tax for this country, which has never had a value-added tax and then a flat tax, as Cruz proposes. So he tries to say it's simple because you could file with a postcard. But as far as the voters understanding it, even a PhD in economics understanding it, it's not so clear what the implications are going to be for the economy because it's so transformative. It really is quite radical in terms of changes in tax policy.
We get postcard, that word that he emphasizes. Behind it, I don't know. Jack, you've been out on the trail. The economy, stupid, was a phrase that came out of the Clinton years. Are you feeling that this time? Are people saying jobs and the economy number one, or is it a bigger consideration of the options for the country here?
I haven't heard it coming up in questions. I mean, people ask about jobs, and Bernie Sanders speaks to that, straight ahead. We're going to have massive, I think he says, 10 million jobs through infrastructure spending to be paid for. Well, we're not really sure. Maybe a transaction tax on Wall Street. But more you hear people talking more broadly about a kind of economic security that maybe even goes beyond jobs, and it seems to almost, there's a nostalgia to it. There was once a time, Bill Clinton's time, maybe when he ran, when you could have a decent middle class life in this country, and somehow that's vanishing. And I feel that again and again. It's not something you can tie to tax programs, but that it's an sort of overall gestalt of anxiety about what's happening to the middle class.
In some ways, that's kind of unsettling. It's sort of a dream state consideration. I mean, after everything in the economy is ultimately nuts and bolts and dollars and cents and how you get it done. Stand by for a second. Fred Tice joins us right now, one of my colleagues, reporter for WBUR. Don't have him quite yet. We'll go to Fred as soon as we can get him in here. I've got a little tape here of Bernie Sanders and what he would like to see, at least a piece of it. Here's Bernie Sanders. This is a campaign rally in Durham, New Hampshire yesterday. Sanders renewing his promise to make the economy work for more than just the top 1% of Americans.
We are going to raise the minimum wage, not the $7.25 an hour starvation minimum wage we have now, but we're going to raise that to a living wage, $15 an hour over the next few years. We are going to have pay equity for women workers.
And there's a lot more on that Bernie Sanders list. It goes on and on and on. Things are going to be very different around here. 10 million jobs, he says, Heather. And he says socialism, and he's got no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Democratic socialism, call it what you will. Have you dug into an actual plan from Sanders on the economy? What would it feel like viscerally?
Well, first of all, his plans are coming up rather late. He was criticized for his Medicare for All plan, the details of it really coming late in the game.
By no less than Bill Clinton recently.
To pay for all this, I mean, there's three key parts to his economic plan. It's actually expanding Social Security. And, on the Republican side, we're talking about contracting, making sure it's solvent.
Except for Trump.
Right.
I guess.
Well, and Chris Christie talked about that very early in the. Mm-hmm. I've covered him a lot. He talked about making sure it's solvent for future generations, which means scaling it back for the wealthy. Mm-hmm. Jeb Bush has also been behind that. Here we have Bernie Sanders on the whole other spectrum, who says let's beef it up. And so we have that. We have the Medicare for All, which is basically universal health coverage, and tuition-free college. So these are some very big proposals. So paying for that, we're still parsing through all the details, but one of it is huge tax increases for...
$1 trillion a year, it's been estimated, the Sanders tax increases would mean, mostly aimed at high-income households, but only?
No, not just high-income households, but when we're talking about the tax rate for high income households, we're talking over 50%. I mean, that hasn't been discussed.
52-58% people are estimating.
This has not been discussed in decades.
And the middle class would have some increases as well. Ross Cattell, when that comes up, Bernie says, yes, but you're going to get a lot in return. You're going to have health care coverage for everybody. We're going to have free college. A good bargain.
Well, I think there's a significant proportion of New Hampshire voters that like that bargain, particularly the young voters and those who really feel the pain of the economy right now. And you mentioned in your opening, Tom, that the concern and fear about the economy and about their economic future, and they're looking for change. You know, so the candidates that are offering the most extreme change, Sanders and Cruz and Trump, are doing very well in that context in New Hampshire.
We were with Donald Trump last night, and boy, does he promise the world. Everything's going to be great. Everything's going to be beautiful. The hospitals, the roads, the schools, the military is going to be a thing of beauty. On and on.
It's not going to cost anything either.
Well, and it's going to be, and we're going to pay less for it. We're going to pay because these fools don't know how to negotiate, and I, Donald J. Trump, do. You know, there is some logic to it, but we'll see how far it goes. Just how far it goes. Jack Beatty, stand by. Ross Cattell, Heather Haddon with The Wall Street Journal. It's great to have you here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are in Manchester, New Hampshire for primary voting day. First in the nation, full primary vote, and we're looking at what the different presidential candidates see for the American economy. The economic way ahead under a Trump, a Sanders, a Clinton, a Cruz, and more. You can join us this hour. Who's got the vision of the American economy that speaks to you? Are you paying attention to the details? Do they add up? Are you tuned in to just how different these candidates' economic visions are? Who would really make America great again on the economic front? With Heather Haddon covering the campaign for the Wall Street Journal with us today in Manchester, New Hampshire. Ross Cattell is here, Chancellor of the Community College System of New Hampshire, former professor at the Whitmore School of Business and Economics at the university. Jack Beatty is right here. Wall Street, big deal. I mean, watch how it's rocking lately. Also, who's attached to Wall Street and how, who's tough on it, who's not. Here's Hillary Clinton yesterday, right here in Manchester, New Hampshire, responding to Bernie Sanders' attacks on her history of accepting campaign donations from Wall Street. Said Wall Street donations do not mean she can be bought by special interests.
I haven't just talked. I haven't just given speeches. I've introduced legislation. I've called them out. I've gone to Wall Street. I've said they were going to wreck the economy over the mortgage markets. They know where I stand because I have always stood there.
What are New Hampshire voters thinking about everything? We talked to Don Murphy yesterday, sitting at a bar in Manchester, New Hampshire, where just a few minutes later, Ted Cruz would be up front citing Jesus and the Bible. But hey, it's American politics. It's all there. He said, I asked him what he was looking for in a candidate.
If we do not get our fiscal house in order, nothing else matters. We cannot continue to have that deficit clock go up to the point where what we are doing to our kids and our grandchildren is just unconscionable. And these guys are doing it.
Don Murphy at a Cruz event yesterday, and he could cite me the numbers off of that deficit clock. How do people's interests break down here? It is unpredictable this year. We had a Trump rally last night, big Trump rally in Manchester, New Hampshire. I spoke with Sarah Duvall. Her party affiliation here at the Trump rally, well, she's a registered Democrat.
I'm here because I want to take the opportunity to educate myself about all the candidates on both sides of the aisle because I don't always vote straight Democrat. Yeah.
And who knows what's going to happen there. Ross, Heather, Jack, stand by. Fred Tice joins us right now, reporter, colleague at WBUR. He's been on the campaign trail a lot in New Hampshire, and he is out in the thick of it today. Fred, thank you very much for being with us. Where are you, Fred? What are you seeing?
Hi, Tom. Yes, you're right. I'm very much in the thick of a traffic jam of voters coming in and out of the parking lot here at Broad Street Elementary School in Nashua. As I look at the houses around me, this is clearly a middle-class neighborhood in Nashua. And Nashua, like all the other towns along the Massachusetts borders, are expected to figure prominently, especially in the Republican part of the primary here, because there's so many Republicans here along the Massachusetts border.
And what are you hearing about top economic issues from voters in this primary season, Fred?
So a very mixed picture. From the Republican voters, people this morning have been telling me they are very worried about the national debt, but also that they're worried about health insurance, their own, Medicare, Medicaid. I've also had voters giving me pushback on the Republican side saying, you know, it's not about the economy. It's about foreign policy. It's about immigration. It's about drug addiction, a big issue here in New Hampshire. It's about national defense. On the Democratic side, I was told I was going to meet a lot of Democratic voters here, but I actually just ran into one Sanders voter. And for him, the issue was not at all about the economy. His choice between Clinton and Sanders is all about integrity and character in the candidate.
Fred, what's the feeling out there? Are people sort of giddy with the range of options this time on the table? Or you're in pretty solid Republican territory as we speak right now. Are they unsettled by the range of options they have from Cruz to Trump to Kasich to Rubio?
No, I'm getting the sense that people are feeling quite good about the choices that they have, whether it be for Donald Trump, for John Kasich. Those are the voters that I'm really running into here. Obviously the Sanders voters are very enthusiastic about their candidate as well. Generally a sense of great enthusiasm.
Fred Tice, a colleague at WBUR and in Nashua, New Hampshire today, in the thick of all the voting. Fred, thank you so much for joining us for a minute.
Glad to do it, Tom.
Heather Haddon, let's look at Donald Trump's actual plans for a minute. I mean, his promises, there's kind of no end to them, but he puts them all in this envelope that, look, I'm a businessman with a track record. I know what I'm talking about. He's not cut. He says, no, Medicare, not going to touch. Social Security, we're going to make it strong, and everything's going to be better. What's his plan? How?
A lot of voters and a lot of in the media still want to know that. So very early on, he did release some proposals. He has a 6-page tax plan. It reduces rates. I believe it's down to 25% for the top earners, which will help a lot of his higher income friends get a real reduction.
And that's a big gift to top earners.
And then all the way down to 0%. And for the very poor, all they have to do is take their 1-page tax form and write, I win, and send it to the IRS. So,
are you jesting, madam?
No. And it's been a struggle, I have to say, as a reporter to... I think we've all struggled how seriously to take Donald Trump's plans. He really has no economic advisor. He is this is all very instinctive, I think, to him. But voters don't care. I mean, you know, I've been to those rallies as well. I mean, what they really like is he's a businessman.
Yeah.
They think he can run a successful business, even though some of his businesses have had bankruptcies, problems in the past.
Yes.
But they trust him. And I don't think voters this year are really looking for all that detail.
Ross, you've been a professor of business and economics. Can a businessman take that into the... I mean, Ross Perot proposed this before. Others have done the same thing. I heard it from Trump supporters last night here in New Hampshire. He knows how to do deals. He knows how to negotiate. And Trump saying from the podium last night, I'm going to bring in the roughest, toughest deal makers in this country. We've got great deal makers in America. You may not like them. They may not be pretty, but they know how to do business. I'm going to bring them in when all the guys in the Western get together and ride into town, and we're going to cut deals with China, and we're going to cut deals with Japan. And we're going can you do that? Can you just bring a bunch of business guys to the White House and cut new deals and off we go?
Yeah, well, I think the voters' perspective is that Congress has gridlock. Congress and politicians can't get it done.
Yeah.
So that business people actually produce things. They have to manage to a bottom line, and they know how to lead. And so they're looking at somebody like Trump, not getting into the details about his policies, and saying, I don't like what's going on now. I don't trust politicians. They haven't been able to get it done. We need somebody who's going to get it done. And he talks, I mean, almost every other word out of his mouth is he's going to get it done. He's going to make deals, and he's going to make it work for America and get us back to the good times.
Can it happen? Can he spin the dials, Heather? I mean, last night he was going on the price of pharmaceuticals. Crazy. We don't negotiate. He sounded like a Democrat, and we're going to go in there. We're going to negotiate. Why should everybody else in the world pay so much less than we do? Bang, bang, bang. I'm going to put it on the table and get it done.
That's actually a new part of his stump speech. Only recently has he started taking on the pharmaceutical companies, and this is part of his whole kind of populist pitch that he cannot be bought. So he is not receiving money from lobbyists. He's not receiving money from the drug companies. So he can go out there and negotiate deals. The problem is he's talking about Medicare costs, which by currently by law cannot be negotiated. So he would have to go to Congress. I mean, this would not be just as waving a magic wand like he seems to be suggesting.
Let's get callers in here. Wayland, Massachusetts. Mike is calling. Mike, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
I've been following the candidate pretty close. I'm a 50-something. My kids are all grown out of the house. I've got grandkids. But I'm what you call the lower end of the middle class.
Okay.
I'm not an educated man. I grew up in a time where you got a blue-collar job.
I hear you.
For a union company and made good money.
Yep.
What I haven't heard from any of the candidates are, I would take that back. Mr. Sanders has come pretty close, but still I haven't got a definitive answer. Not all of us can be a hedge fund manager. Not all of us can be a doctor, a lawyer, or work at
Amen.
Home about.
Yep.
We need jobs that are good-paying, blue-collar jobs. And nobody, and I haven't heard anybody, far less on the Republican side, but on the Democrat side, they talk it. At least they address the issue, but they don't give specifics of how they're going to bring back good, blue-collar jobs. I think this economy could have been better by this point, but I think we've dealt with a divided government. One part of the government trying to bring the other one down. Obama has had nothing but an uphill battle. I mean, a guy named Mitch McConnell right out of the box said he was never going to cooperate with this guy and do the best he could to bring the guy down. When I heard that, I knew right away we were in trouble, and we have been.
Mike, we've got it, and we hear that appeal for, come on, jobs and jobs for everybody. It's not just hedge funds and private equity, not even just doctors and lawyers, please. Jack, you hear a lot of language, I must say, on the trail. I mean, Trump says we're going to have, you know, we're going to rebuild everything. China's got all the great infrastructure, now we're going to have it here. He says we'll bring the jobs back from China, back from Japan, back from Mexico. We'll rebuild this country. That would include a lot of blue-collar jobs. But is it credible?
Economically, it's not credible to say that jobs that have been essentially lost to the world labor market are going to be coming back unless our labor market accommodates or unless we have massive protectionism. Now, he does also favor protectionism. So it's a quixotic and sort of bootless promise to say we're going to bring those jobs back. They're lost not to technology, but to simply the world, you know, the wage gap.
Is there some way that could be done, Ross? Could the USA now, in this century, go mercantile all of a sudden, lay down a whole lot of leverage? You want our markets, you're going to have to play it our way, throw out the World Trade Organization,
I mean, the economy is a global economy. There's a lot of benefits to that for the U.S. Yeah. economy. There's also costs. And I think the candidates that address what are the costs and how to overcome those negatives associated with free trade have a viable plan that includes investment in education and training. And that's why there's the discussion on the Democratic side about free community college, Bernie Sanders' free college for all those who attend public universities or colleges. The Republicans have some discussions about that. I know Kasich talks about the need to invest in education. And Rubio has talked about vocational training to transform education, and that's what's needed.
Instead of philosophers, we need welders.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, instead of philosophers, welders. Here's Rubio. This is the debate in Manchester Saturday, touching on economic policy, talking about the meaning of conservatism.
The reason why free enterprise is the greatest economic model in the history of the world is because it's the only economic model where you can make poor people richer without making rich people poor.
Yes, but. We know it's complicated, and we've seen that, felt that, our caller Mike and many others. Wall Street's been wobbling like crazy in recent weeks and wobbling in a very downward direction, Heather. Who, just on that front, a lot of people don't give a hoot right now, but who's going to calm them down or who would really get them rocking?
Well, I think Sanders has really, I mean, pushed Hillary to the left on his whole attacks on Wall Street. And I think that's been very effective. And I think it's really resonated with voters. And I think Hillary still hasn't come up with a really good, sound explanation for the contributions she's gotten from Wall Street. I mean, during the last debate, she said President Obama also got Wall Street contributions.
I'm not the only one. Everybody does it.
There was calls for her to release her speeches that she's done in front of big financial companies. Mm-hmm. She has not done that. Mm-hmm. So I think Bernie really has struck a nerve here. He certainly has a lot of taxes that he would like to apply to Wall Street. I don't think Wall Street is going to like that so much, but that's really his approach.
And it is a big tower of change that he promises. Heather Haddon with The Wall Street Journal with us here in Manchester, New Hampshire. It's been so great to have you. Thank you very much for stopping by.
Thanks so much.
Great to have you. Let's go to Cliff in Claremore, Oklahoma. Cliff, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Yes. Personally, I think with the statement that was just made, I think they need to board up Wall Street and revitalize Main Street. That's one of the first things. And I am supporting Bernie Sanders. I know that seems kind of strange, especially being in the Generation X crowd, but most of the millennials that are supporting Sanders were born when Bill Clinton was president. And at the time, Bill Clinton seemed more to the left of the Republicans, but it seemed that the Democrats have stayed centrist throughout, and it seems like that's made the Republicans move further and further and further to the right. And then our economic policies have made us suffer and made people who, like that other guy that you had on the air, working class that can barely make ends meet. And that's part of what has been happening, and I think Bernie Sanders has resonated with that appeal, and I think most of the younger people have pretty much got on to that message.
Cliff, I appreciate your call. I mean, there is, of course, a range. Super popular with young people, but we happened to run into some young Rubio supporters last night. I want to give you just a flavor of what they had to say. They were standing outside, bitter cold, with his signs waiting for Rubio to come out. I asked them why they thought that there were so many young people out for Bernie Sanders. This is what one of the Rubio supporters, Andrew, had to say.
They want free stuff, and I mean, quite simply, they want free stuff. And that,
I mean, really think they're all just slackers, honestly.
I don't think that all of them are slackers, but I think that some of them just want free stuff and they want to change America into a socialist country, and that is just awful. I can't imagine that ever.
Youth for Rubio in Manchester, New Hampshire last night. Margaret Tolob joins us right now, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. Margaret, what a year. Well, we've got so many young people turning out for Bernie Sanders, but you hear the Rubio young folks right there saying, this is awful, this is the worst, this is so, we're not going there. What a chasm we've got, even in that generation.
It's actually also really ironic, since Sanders would actually probably tax earners at those speakers' income levels, whereas Rubio would say, you know, if you put your money in the stock market, you can just cash it out and don't worry about the capital gains.
No capital gains.
So free stuff is in the eye of the beholder a little bit, isn't it? But it's certainly a debate about, it's the age-old debate, right? How much should government give you? Should government give you a complete security blanket on healthcare, on your retirement, on that sort of stuff? And that's the age-old debate that remains. But
age-old, but turbocharged now, where Bernie wants to promise a lot more.
But you got to pay more for it.
Well,
I mean, that's the
taxes.
Deal. Everybody's got to pay more for it. Almost everybody under his plan has got to pay a little bit more. And then you get more, he says.
You've got a sense of the politics in this country. When those tax bills would come, do you think Americans could get used to that?
No.
Really? But they've got universal coverage, health care coverage now. They've got free college.
That's a decades-long getting used to it, don't you think?
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace helps you showcase every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today. Visit squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint. You should. Squarespace.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are in Manchester, New Hampshire for primary voting day, first in the nation. Iowa has its caucuses, New Hampshire has its primaries, and they are on today. Everybody looking at the outcome of those for who will move ahead and in what kind of shape. We're looking in this hour at the U.S. economy and what the approaches of different candidates might mean for that economy. It has been bad. It has been better. It's a little shaky right now. Look at Wall Street. Who knows where it will be by November? What would these candidates bring to the table as president? Ross Cattell is with us. He's chancellor of the Community College System of New Hampshire, former professor in the Whitmore School of Business and Economics at the university. Jack Beattie is with us, On Point news analyst. He's been all over New Hampshire talking with all kinds of people about what they see in this race. Margaret Tolov is with us from Bloomberg News. There's a name, Bloomberg, White House correspondent there, and with us today in Manchester, New Hampshire. You can join us as well. What do you think Trump would really do for the economy? What would Sanders really mean for the economy? Have you dug into Hillary's promise not to raise taxes on the middle class? Is it still just a beauty contest out there? Is the economy on your mind? The choices to be made? What makes sense now for the U.S. economy? We've got a lot of callers here. Tom in Worcester, Ohio. Tom, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much. I wanted to call and talk about John Kasich. I live in Ohio. I'm an Ohio resident nearly all my life, and I just wanted to kind of talk about, you know, you mentioned in the first hour, and I won't dwell on it, about blowing the party up. If the party needs blown up, then there's something fundamentally wrong. I think politics is polarized. That's kind of why I like John Kasich. He's gone against his party on some key issues, the expansion of Medicaid, just to name one. I like him because you don't necessarily always like what he has to say, mm-hmm. but I think that you can trust it. You know, he's balanced our budget. I think that he's managed our natural gas resources in the state of Ohio really well. And I think that if he has a good New Hampshire showing, that more focus from the media will be put on him. Folks will be able to get to hear his whole message, how he bucked his own party to expand Medicaid, balancing budgets. And also, you know, I like the fact that you guys brought it up in the first hour, how he wants to look after the folks in the shadows. I really think that if he has a good New Hampshire bounce, that he's going to be a good centrist candidate that a lot of swing voters, and I know swing voters because I'm from the state of Ohio, a lot of swing voters could get behind him. Thank
Tom,
you.
Tom, let us pick it up. Tom in Worcester, Ohio, standing up for his man there, for his governor there, Jack. I mean, and in Iowa, Kasich kind of invisible. In New Hampshire, he is not. But that centrist thing, does that work?
It's true so far. And yet, when you look at Kasich and really at the whole Republican field, and he goes around with a debt clock, and yet the motto of his
the
campaign.
Debt clock. A lot of voters talked about Kasich and his debt clock. He carries it around and shows that giant number that we. The
but his owns. Tax cut would be the largest for in American history for the wealthy, according to one.
Need a bigger clock.
You need a bigger clock. So you know, yes, all these, but the Republican orthodoxy: taxes must be cut, and they especially must be cut for the top brackets. That doesn't work with, you know, the frugal spending centrist idea at all, I don't think.
What about, Ross, we saw in the debate, Kasich always brings up his economic record in Iowa. Donald Trump, who's always looking for that way to come and smack somebody back down, said, hey, that is just fracking. You got lucky. You won the fracking natural gas lottery. It's got nothing to do with your economic wisdom, John Kasich.
I think there's quite a bit of substance to what he did in Ohio, you know, a declining industrial economy, and he took some actions as governor to help recover jobs in Ohio. The track record of the jobs recovery compared to some other Midwestern states is quite good. He does have the executive experience, so I think some people look to somebody with that gubernatorial executive experience compared to an untested senator who's never really run anything by themselves. So I think he can speak to his record, not only as governor, but in fact, when he was in the Congress was the last time the federal government balanced the budget, played a role in that. So he has a track record, and he talks about some of the challenges out there and their substance behind his plan.
Margaret, our caller from Ohio says, give me a centrist, please, on the economy and kind of everything else.
Yeah.
Care about the people in the shadows, even while we build the economy. But does a centrist play this time? And if they do, who's a centrist exactly? Is Donald Trump in some way a centrist? Because he's certainly got kind of left and right stuff in his bag of economic prescriptions.
So Donald Trump has very much tried to play to the white, blue-collar, working-class sector. And he has the same appeal that Sanders does in many levels to those voters, but to those
We've heard Sanders, people choose him between Sanders and Trump. We heard it just last night.
But it's the voters that are those voters but want to identify Republican are more likely to go with Trump. Those voters who want to identify Democrat more likely to go with Sanders. Although if you look at Trump's plans, he kind of co-opt is probably too strong a word. I'll use it anyway. He gets those voters in his corner while hugely helping very wealthy people. And it's kind of the middle class that gets hollowed out under the Trump plans, right?
Kasich, hang on to your hat, people.
Right. But Kasich is a little bit different. Kasich, I think, does appeal to the center, appeals to those Republican voters who wanted to back Jeb Bush, but he turned out not to be a great candidate, wanted to back Chris Christie, but he had problems with Bridgegate and sit down and shut up and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's there. The problem is that it's not a centrist year on the nominating side. And don't forget that John Kasich worked for Lehman Brothers. There was that. I think part of the reason that people increasingly talk about him as a strong vice presidential candidate is because at this point, at least, the conventional wisdom doesn't seem to say that the Republican Party is in a place where enough of the different contingents could rally around Kasich and make him the nominee. Of course, that could change. Anything could change. This year has been such a wild card of a year. But when it comes time to a general election ballot, I met a guy in the elevator at my hotel earlier this week, New Hampshire guy, big burly guy with a lumberjack, kind of like a flannel shirt.
It wasn't Bill Clinton.
No, it was like, no, an actual lumberjack.
Putting on the dog, okay.
and in the 2 minutes that we rode up in the elevator together, he was telling me he was a Democrat, but he was thinking about voting for John Kasich. I think that's a real thing, but it doesn't apply in primaries the same way it would apply in an open contest.
There's just such a swing here. Sanders backing tax increases of more than $1 trillion a year aimed mostly at high-income households. GOP candidates, I'm reading here, proposing massive tax cuts that would largely benefit those same taxpayers. Between Sanders and Trump, a $2 trillion swing, almost 10% of GDP, and what they would bring in and how.
Well, you asked who's the most centrist. I think in some ways Hillary Clinton is the most centrist. No middle class tax cut. Incrementalism on the spending side, public, early childhood education, help with tuition, taxes, yes, going up, but only on millionaires, and a kind of, in this field, it seems to me, she's the most centrist.
Kasich wants to own it. Here he was in Plaistow, New Hampshire yesterday, talking about his experience trying to balance the budget in Washington.
When I was in Washington, I spent 10 years of my life trying to get that budget balanced, and we did. And we had surpluses, and we paid down $500 billion of the debt, and we had balanced budgets for 4 years in a row. And it's not that hard to balance a budget.
It's not that hard. It's not that hard. It looks hard to me. Let's go to St. Paul, Minnesota. Tom's calling. Hi, Tom. You're on there. Tom's everywhere today. Hi, Tom. You're on.
Hi. Hey, I wanted to bring some perspective here and a little bit of history. Sanders' program is not radical. It's simply FDR New Deal socialism. In fact, there were two articles in the New Yorker magazine. One was called Bernie's FDR Socialism, and the other one was called Was Eisenhower More Socialist Than Sanders? Okay. And they went on in that one article to talk about how in the 50s under Eisenhower, the top marginal rate was 91% for the, those making over 2 million.
Yep.
The economy we did just fine. We had free college tuition in California in the 60s when tax rates were higher before Reagan. Medicare for all, if you expand it to everyone, it's a successful program. Your taxes go up, but you save double in premiums. And infrastructure spending on and on and on the jobs, Jack Beatty. Of course, you just eliminate NAFTA, CAFTA, TPP. Our trade deals are a joke. I mean, everybody else uses protectionism through VAT taxes. We can do the same. And Warren Buffett and other patriotic billionaires like Nick Hanauer, want to raise their own taxes to get us back where we were.
We hear it. You're a smart guy. You got a good list. But Bernie Sanders himself says political revolution. Is it not that he's proposing?
Reagan was a political
revolution. I thought you were saying it's nothing. It's no big deal.
It's not radical. It's a revolution to go back to the way it was. And Americans have this fear of the word socialism. We have socialism all over this country. Like Social Security is socialism. Medicare is socialism. And Americans love it.
Yeah. I hear you loud and clear. And clearly the country has drifted off and way off from FDR. It would be a turn to get there. But you're saying, wait, we've been there before. Do you agree, Russ Cattell? What Bernie Sanders is putting on the table is just FDR New Deal 2. It's just... Eisenhower would be more socialist than Sanders.
I think what's most relevant is the context is so different than it was in FDR's time. We're 60, 70 years past that
time.
Why
does that matter? People still need to make a living. Blue-collar people still need to have a place in our society and in our economy. Equity is still equity.
Well, it matters because the global economy has changed, too. So the position of the U.S. economy, coming out of World War II was very different than it is now. And to say, okay, we're going to flip on a dime back to the FDR policies doesn't truly reflect the reality that we went through this period of the Reagan Revolution and the downsizing of government and the attitude that government doesn't work.
Can we not get back there? Our caller certainly thinks we did it before, and we can and should do it again, Margaret.
I think a big part of the unknown in all of this, in addition to how people would feel about having to pay higher taxes and have their insurance in a different way and stuff, is the implications on the markets. And, as Bill Clinton found out many years after his presidency was over, the long-term implications of major shifts on everything from welfare to trade deals are different than the short-term effects. You can have a bump in the short term and a drag in the long term, or perhaps in this case, a freaking out in the short term, and maybe it wouldn't be that bad in the long term. But because it's a global economy, the fact that the implications of radical change are hard to predict.
St. Paul Tom says, not radical, not radical.
Right.
Don't say radical.
It's radical. So, of course, it's a big deal. The candidate himself is campaigning on the notion that it's a revolution. And this would be whether people voted for him or not, if he were to actually have success moving forward with these plans, if he were president, it would have major implications on the way we receive services.
Back to the future or future to the back. I don't know what it is, Jack.
Well, at the high point of American liberalism in 1965, the New Republic came out with a title, a cover that said, "We are all liberals now." And that was the year of Medicare for LBJ. 70% of Americans thought government could be trusted to do the right thing most of the time. Now, 19%. To Tom, that's the big political challenge facing Bernie Sanders. He says trust the government in an unprecedented way, and boy, this will all work out in the end. Well,
there's an army of young people who seem to be saying, yes, okay, it will be different. Jeff in Surrey, Virginia. Jeff, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, yeah, thanks. I actually want to agree with the previous caller. I mean, my point was going to be the fact that we've moved, it's been policy prescriptions, trade agreements that have moved us towards a global economy over the past 50 years. And, there's nothing that says it's not radical. There's nothing that says we can't move away from that. We can't adopt some protectionist policies. And, the other thing I would point to is the fact that the transmission of services and ideas, that can happen through, internet technology now, regardless of the goods, the products. So we can bring production, we can decentralize that, bring that back to local countries and local economies, but you can keep the sharing economy for the ideas, the technologies. A lot of that stuff can still have a multiplying effect on local.
I don't know. Maybe you can have it both ways. One would like to think so. It is interesting that both Trump and Sanders are sort of throw the brakes on globalization and turn that train around. Is that realistic, Ross Cattell?
I don't think it's realistic, again, because what we're ignoring in this discussion has been some of the benefits from global trade, the access to products and services from around the world, the opening of markets and how that's created jobs here in the U.S. for people and led to foreign direct investment here by other countries. So if you turn your backs on other countries, what's going to happen to the investment that we have here from other countries? So I think it's short-sighted and not reflective of the global realities right now in the economy. And it really, you think of some of the Sanders supporters, some of the Trump supporters, they want to see, who's the culprit?
Mm-hmm.
What's the reason for their economic pain? And the Sanders, it's Wall Street, you know, and some free trade. With Trump, it's China and the immigrants. Mm-hmm. And they're both looking for the problem. And if you address that problem, the economy is going to work for everybody. It doesn't work that way. You need to invest in human capital, in education and training. And you have to make sure that markets work effectively for a broad cross-section of the population. We're in a market economy. The U.S. economy over time has done very well with the market economy. To say Wall Street is the business model is total fraud, I don't think reflects the economic reality. Well,
so you say, and I hear you, but a whole lot of people are now out there holding Bernie Sanders right now as we speak. Yeah. Margaret Tall, this conversation seems to take the whole, you know, people say we can't even agree on a reality anymore. Yeah. And ratchet that up to another level on the economy.
That's such a good point. I mean, Trump and Sanders are different in the fact that Sanders, among the things he wants to do in terms of increasing government services, is the free college tuition, just like Hillary talks about. But it is instructive. It says something that these two guys who are both trying to appeal to working class, to blue collar voters who are sort of cut out of the game, the system is rigged, et cetera, that there is, Forbes did this fabulous study, literally a $25 trillion swing in their two plans. And
that number beggars the imagination.
Because they see it from almost the completely opposite perspective, if you take that money out of the federal coffers, if you're putting that much less tax money in, as Trump would do, that you get a benefit in the markets. And from Sanders' side, he's betting that if you take that extra money in, it pays for health care, it pays for Medicare for all, it pays for college for everybody without a detrimental effect on the market. That is a big disagreement.
Wow. And out of that, in the Sanders view, comes this big, healthy, happy, his ads appear playing Simon and Garfunkel.
Oh, yes, right. America.
Yeah, we'll marry our fortunes together, was the lyric. I don't know how merry that will be. Voters deciding today in New Hampshire, and the impact of the voting here will roll right on across the country. Margaret Tolliv, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. It is always great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks,
in Manchester. Tom. Ross Cattell, Chancellor of the Community College System of New Hampshire. Educate them well, Ross, and thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Teach our children well. And Jack Beattie, always great to have you.
Thank you.
Right here in Manchester, New Hampshire. We're out into the crunchy snow. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.